beginning our, say, fourth full day or fourth day. Hopefully people are settling in. Feels like it. But I live in my own little world. That's certainly the feeling. People are settling into the retreat. I had a request for to speak about practicing with physical pain, so that I'd say a good opportunity to reflect on physical pain as a part of practice, because sometimes the sometimes just the assumption of, if I were practicing rightly, then I wouldn't feel any pain. Bad idea. it's really a good way to sort of ramp up the difficulty with that. Yeah, physical pain is already painful. And then to add the say mental pain around judgment and whatnot is sort of increasing the it's like the Buddha's image of the second arrow. If you get hit with one arrow and that's painful enough, and you take another arrow and just stab yourself with it. So it's to recognize that when we're creating mental pain around the physical pain as well. And it's hard not to, because there's a discourse where the Buddha talks about, and he said, and I'm not going to get it quite right, but something like that, when somebody talks about there being a bottomless chasm in the ocean, that's something that is just kind of made up. It's not talking about something that doesn't exist. But then the Buddha goes on to say, but I say actually, say the term bottomless chasm is another term for bodily pain. So that's what it feels like when one is in the midst of physical pain, and it feels like one is being pulled into some bottomless pit, so that it's definitely not a pleasant experience, and can be overwhelming. But the Buddha made a point of addressing the fact that there are say fundamentally there's three kinds of feeling: pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neutral feeling. And to be able to relate to these different kinds of feelings and it's like feeling tone. It's not the emotion around it, it's a basic kind of feeling. Relate to the feeling, one of, say, a pleasant feeling, to be able to view pleasant feeling as stressful. Because oftentimes what we want to do is with painful feeling, and we say we long for the pleasant, if only I got some pleasant feeling, then I'd be happy again. But that's fraught as well. It's not as if it's certainly a relief, but again, to be alert to how we frame it, what we are trying to gain from it, to get from it, and so that recognizing that the pleasant feeling is stressful. It has that element of, because of its constructed nature, because of the way that we pin our hopes on it, or we formulate desire around it, how we lament when it changes, it is stressful. It's not that it's not useful or beneficial or even, you know, worthy of cultivation, but it's also relating to it skillfully. And then painful feeling is to be seen as an arrow. The Buddha giving that image. Okay, yeah. Nobody sort of wanders around looking, how many arrows can I get shot with today? It's not how it works. And then neutral feeling, neither painful, neither pleasant, is to be seen as inconstant, as changing, as impermanent, recognizing the change in that. Because sometimes even when things are neutral, sort of like we can get dreary, or we tend to drift with it because it's not grabbing our attention. Because sometimes, whether it's pleasant or painful, those grab our attention. Whereas with the neutral, and in reality, a lot of our life is actually neutral. It's not outstanding, nothing, all that. Either delightful or disastrous, and it's. But then we keep moving away from the neutral, usually without awareness, because we don't recognize its uncertain nature, its impermanent nature, its inconstant nature. So that to be relating to feeling with a degree of awareness of those spectrums and what the mind does. Now, with painful feeling, that physical pain, and it is, especially if where we have chronic pain, or we're having, say, a long period of illness or some injury that goes on and on. Then that feeling of it being a bottomless chasm can really pull one in. And sometimes there's a tendency to kind of dissociate from the body when pain is severe. And there's a balance, because there's a skillful way of, say, disidentifying or not identifying with the pain, but then there's an unskillful way of doing that, in the sense where one pulls away from, dissociates from the body, and then it's like a pushing away, an annihilating of the sense of being. It's from vipava tanha, and it's quite understandable, but it's important to recognize that there's a very different effect, in the sense that when we dissociate with vipava tanha, then there's a kind of a suppressing of recognition of, and we just want to escape. But then by a certain stepping back from non-identification with the body, grounded in awareness, there can be a separation that isn't based on, say, annihilation or aversion. What it does elicit is a lot of compassion. And it's, you know, it's obviously a hard line to navigate, but it's important to recognize that there is a line there, and we can play with that, work with that, experiment with that, see how we can deal with that, and what we can, what can we learn from that. There's a discourse where Anuruddha, who was one of the foremost disciples of the Buddha, he was foremost in his knowledge of the divine eye, so quite accomplished meditator. He was also the Buddha's cousin, Ananda's half-brother. So that was early years of Buddhism were a family business. So Anuruddha is described as being severely ill, racked with pain, diseased. And the monks ask him, how is it that you can, what is your abiding place? What is your dwelling place? And not physically, what is your dwelling place when you are experiencing this physical condition, this disease, illness, pain? And Anuruddha replies very briefly, very simply, that my abiding place is the four foundations of mindfulness. And it's easy to think, that's pretty mundane, pretty ordinary. But once you start realizing how, when the mind can take those four foundations of mindfulness, be present within the body, within feeling, within mind, within mind objects, within phenomena, then the mind has an abiding place of truth. And when we abide in that which is true, in the sense of when we have Dhamma as an abiding place, there's a refuge. There's a refuge that one can turn to. And it's not just, I think this is where say practice of Buddhism shifts from being a meditation technique to a religion or some people really cringe at that, but in the sense that there's a whole structure of teachings and practices and world views, self views that are all linked together, and this Dhamma that the Buddha taught is a Dhamma of truth. It's a Dhamma of liberation, and it is a refuge. So that sometimes, devotion or faith plays a huge role in our ability to experience the fruits of the Dhamma, being able to recognize that, the Dhamma is really a worthy refuge, and it lifts up the heart. So that in picking up that as a perspective, then you realize you've got a much broader perspective, a lot larger kind of something much larger to hold you, and that's really important. Is the when it's me dealing with my pain, And whether it's physical pain or mental pain and anguish, you know, that's, we get pulled into a bottomless chasm. But when we have a refuge that we have confidence in, we have devotion towards, it lifts us up out of the limitations of our individual self perspective, and we can hold it, but we don't dissociate. So it's sort of okay. There's pain, and there's difficulty, and there's dukkha, and there's all of that, and there is a refuge, and there is a path leading to cessation of suffering. And there is really something that ennobles the human heart. And that's where, say, the ordinary things that we experience, whether it's pleasure, pain, the neutral, they all have an opportunity for transformation. And that's it's really I think it's helpful to hold it in that way. So in working with pain, and I mean, for myself, it's not theoretical. I mean, for those who have known me for a long time, there's recognized that. I spent a lot of time in Thailand, and had a reputation of always being ill, always going to hospital, always having some kind of corrective surgery, always being in some sort of a cast. and it was when Ajahn Amaro and I decided to help each other out, and I would come to help establish a Bhayagiri. That was the one thing that Ajahn Amaro asked me to do was do some kind of special practices, some kind of major adhitana, like determination, and try to have some a modicum of decent health. because America has such a terrible healthcare system, in Thailand you can go to, you get looked after the hospital as a monk. You show up at the hospital and they just sort of you walk in and look after you, and they ask you to stay longer than you. Here, I mean, it just you come in with some major sort of health issue, and there's you sort of patch you up and boot you out on the street, and then give you a huge bill. So he said, we can't afford to have you. So it actually worked. I've been in pretty good health these last 20 years. I mean, I had some health issues, and they all happened in Thailand. It was so dealing with pain has been a feature in my own practice, I have confidence that this teaching of the Buddha's works. And it doesn't mean I don't experience pain, but it means it doesn't overwhelm. And, sometimes you have to know you have to know your limits. You have to be willing to adjust. You have to be willing to surrender, and this is going to come back and bite me, just me saying stuff like that. Because, say, the last few years I've been dealing with real chronic pain because years ago I fractured my pelvis, so, and it's come back to haunt me with hip, lower back pain. So sitting for long periods of time is painful. But and people say, why don't you go back and rest? Yeah, okay, well, maybe tomorrow. Those are, so a lot of it is knowing your limitations, knowing when one needs to pull back and just look after oneself, and then also to, and sometimes knowing when to, okay, extend oneself. And those are there's no fixed kind of guide or rule for that. You can only go by your own experience and your own what actually works for you. But on the other side of feeling, there is that bottomless chasm of painful bodily feeling. But the Buddha also addresses ways in which we actively cultivate, say, pleasant feeling. Not by running around trying to gratify our desires, but by, and particularly in the meditation, lifting up objects of meditation that and ways of directing attention that help to brighten the mind, help to ease the body. Like in the mindfulness of breathing, the Buddha goes on from that first tetrad of using the body as an object of attention, moving to feeling. And in particular, I'm sort of experiencing joy. I breathe in, and this again, training oneself. It's not sort of a random sitting around hoping it'll happen sometime, but training oneself. I'll breathe in, sensitive to joy. I'll breathe out, sensitive to joy. I'll breathe in, and training oneself. I'll breathe in, experiencing pleasure. I'll breathe out, experiencing pleasure. Piti and sukha. And those are qualities of mind that can arise either through relaxing of the body and breathing into the body, so that one is really deeply releasing tension, tightness, softening the body, but imbuing that process with awareness and attention. Not tight, not tense, but you're really soothing the body with the breath. And so in the breathing in, breathing out, soothing the body, and then recognizing that, it just feels better than trying too hard, being too tense, being too tight. And then by giving that attention, that has some space to grow, and that can establish this sense of joy. It's hard to, piti has, the words in the scriptural language are, have a large spectrum of meaning, from just sort of a teensy little tingle of joy to just full-blown rapture. But it's important to pay attention to, oh, that's a good feeling. Just that, just when we release some tension, when we settle, and then as it softens, as the body softens and the heart softens, then there's a feeling of well-being that is there. And as we nurture that with this breathing in, breathing out, it's able to start to gain some momentum, gain some traction in the heart. And of course, this is something that the Buddha encourages, and it's in relationship to the body. In the sense that when we have pain or when we're kind of just fed up with the body, it's easy to dissociate. But then there's a certain numbing that takes place when we do that. But the Buddha's encouragement in the meditation and cultivation of peaceful states of being, those are integrated into the body. So that, like the language that the Buddha uses when one experiencing some pleasure, some well-being from say stepping back, that withdrawing from what's unwholesome, what's unskillful, withdrawing from that frantic attempts to gratify desire, and just that ease that one feels. Then the Buddha says, to permeate and pervade, steep and fill this very body with that pleasure born of withdrawal. It's born of seclusion, where we pull back. We've pulled back from engagement, and there's a peacefulness that's starting to settle. One's been working with the breath, working with the body posture, and one's starting to relax. We're learning how to fill and pervade the whole body with that, and to stick with that. And it's that pleasurable sensation that starts to seep into our whole bodily presence, and then it fills the mind, it fills the heart, so that we're doing it together. Because sometimes that sense of, especially with a lot of pain, if only I didn't have to experience my body, if I didn't have a body, I wouldn't have to feel like this. But then, there is a kind of a numbing that takes place, and it's not helpful. But we can bring that experience, and that's where even in the midst of, say, painful sensation, because there's always this, there's different things going on, like your body can feel uncomfortable, but the mind is really interested in being mindful, interested in being awake. And there's a good feeling with that. Learning how to bring that into that bodily presence, so that we're able to not be overwhelmed by the say, a physical pain. And again, it's not that it's not there, but so much of it is, you know, what options do we have of directing attention and picking up an object that is. And it doesn't have to, of course, it's, again, the Buddha encouraging a sense of, you know, permeating, pervading, steeping and filling this very body. But one can do that. One can also use that. That's why I say that sometimes the, say, like an object of faith is helpful as well, where things like a recollection of the Buddha is a really skillful recollection. This is where the associations that we have with the teachings of the Buddha, the historical Buddha, the archetype of the Buddha, being one who is fully awakened, who is compassionate, who is fully purified. That's an inspiring image and perception to hold in the mind. And that can elicit, feelings of joy, or well-being, delight. And one can be attentive to that, be present with that. Allow that to grow. The development of quite consciously and in a directed way, loving kindness, practices of loving kindness, where we're using those thought processes to direct attention to well-wishing, to caring for others, to wishing for the happiness of ourselves and for others. And it's important that in that cultivation of loving kindness, that we acknowledge that, as we chanted this morning, you begin that chant, "May I abide in well-being." That's your first wish. And to allow oneself to pay attention, give attention to one's own well-being, one's own happiness, not in a selfish, obsessed way, but in the reality that when I feel happy and when I feel at ease, when I feel safe, I've got a lot of space for others, and that that's really important. We're able to hold others in that same wish, in that same intention, when we can do it for ourselves. And the cultivation of metta, of loving kindness, I think it is important to take it beyond just, you know, if I think enough nice thoughts, then I'll be okay. But it's sort of really bringing it into the body. Because loving kindness, or the practice of loving kindness, isn't just about a thought or a concept. It's about a feeling, and the feeling that we experience in our body, in our heart, and trying to make it a tangible feeling, where one brings it into the heart base, and what do I feel? How can I expand that a bit? How can I hold that? One of the images for that cultivation of loving kindness is, because oftentimes it's presented as, you know, where we develop loving kindness, and then we share that loving kindness with others, or we send it forth to others and this direction, that direction, to this person, that person. We end up being sort of loving kindness postman. It gets really tiring. And I think what's a much more helpful way of conceiving it is making it tangible. How's one feeling and how's one experiencing? And when we begin, just these thoughts, feeling of loving kindness, sort of like it's like having a small, bright vessel or dish. And then as it becomes more stable, then that vessel, that dish, expands. It's able to hold more. And you can invite people in. You can invite the world into that. And then that vessel can expand and keep expanding. So it can be holding. But it's always centered right here. It's always held right here in this body, in this mind. Right? And then that is actually, say, energizing, brightening for our being. So as we say we're attentive, or we draw attention to those qualities of well-being, of joy, of pleasure, that starts to gain momentum. And there's an ease that comes into the mind, there's an ease that comes into the body. And it's a way of making it very conscious, because it's like with the Four Noble Truths. Say the truth of suffering, the truth of dukkha, the First Noble Truth, the appropriate duty that we have towards it is to know it clearly, is to understand it. And so that willingness to attend to dukkha, stress, dissatisfaction, dis-ease, the willingness to be present with it, to allow it to be there. It's not just that one's first response is to annihilate it or to run away from it, but to know it. That changes the dynamic that we're able to work with it. So similarly with pain, when we're willing to know it, we're willing to be present with it, we're willing to say, okay, this also has a place. And it doesn't mean one's just acquiescing to it, but it's more like this has to be held skillfully, it has to be known clearly, it has to be understood before I'm able to really deal skillfully with it and be, say, patient with it and find the tools to not be overwhelmed by it, not to be, say, drawn into that bottomless chasm. So it's a different way of working with it, but it's an important perspective that the Buddha gives us, that really allows us to see it, recognize it, but not be overwhelmed, not be oppressed by it. So I'll offer that this morning for contemplation. We can work with it, investigate it.